And I want to give you, before we leave here, five key things that usually keep people from making these seven a reality. I call them the five keys to wealth and happiness. And what they really mean to me are they're the five stumbling blocks that most people go across that keep them from doing the things that can make their life work. And how I came across these five, basically, is I was in Boston one time after a seminar. And I came out and I was walking in Copley Square. I don't know if you've ever been there or not, but it's a pretty historical place, neat place. You know, you've got buildings that have been here since before the United States of America was called the United States of America. And you've got these brand new skyscrapers like the John Hancock building. And so I'm walking through this, you know, part of history, and I'm just thinking and, you know, kind of getting my thoughts together late at night all by myself on the road. There's nobody around. And I glance up, and just down at the end of the road, I see this figure kind of hunched over and kind of stumbling between the street and the sidewalk. And it's getting closer, and it becomes more apparent to me that it's obviously a man, and it looks like he's probably drunk. So he starts to get closer to me. I start to think to myself, you know what? He's probably going to beg me for some money. And as you think, so you attract. So sure enough, this guy comes up to me and he goes, Mister, he said, could you loan me a quarter? He's almost like crying and almost laughing simultaneously. And I thought to myself, do I want to reward this behavior? And then I thought, but I don't want him to suffer. Have you ever had that quandary within yourself, like not quite sure what to do either way? So I thought for a minute, and then I came up with an idea. And I turned to him and I said, is that all you want, is a quarter? And he said, well, yeah, that's all I want, just a quarter. If you would just give me a quarter, my whole life would change. And I said, you're sure, just a quarter? He said, yeah, just one quarter, that's all, just one. So I took out of my pocket all the money that I had. And I had quite a few large bills. And I had some change. So I took out, you know, several $100 bills and other bills, and I put them in my other hand while I looked for a quarter in this hand. And I made sure he saw the other money. You know, and I could see he was seeing it. And I went through it all, and I found one quarter and took all the other money, very slowly put it back in my pocket, took the quarter, and I handed it to him. And as I handed it to him, I said, life will pay whatever price you ask of it. Well, he took the quarter, he looked at the quarter, he looked at me, he looked at my pocket, he looked back at the quarter, he looked at me, and he said, you're crazy! And he stumbled off, you know, with a newspaper in one hand and a bag full of alcohol, obviously, in the other one. And as he stumbled off, you know, all disheveled, and obviously it looked like he'd slept in the street, probably was going to go back and sleep in the street. I thought to myself, you know, what's the difference between him and me? You know, here I am, I was 25 at the time this happened. Here I am, a 25-year-old young man. I'm traveling around the world, literally, talking to leaders, people like yourself who are out talking to people every day, and I get a chance to share ideas that I think matter with people who obviously care. And I mean, my life is a fantasy. I live in a castle, you know, literally, physically. I have the woman of my dreams. I have four children. I have a 19-year-old boy. I have a 13-year-old girl, an 8-year-old boy, and a 3-year-old boy. I started when I was 2. My wife obviously had 3 children before I met her. I mean, I have family. I have wife of my dreams. I obviously have all the money that I need. I have all the toys, supposedly. And I get a chance to have an impact, which is, I think, what we all really want to do. And I was a 25-year-old kid. I thought, why is my life so different than his? Did God just say, well, Robbins, you're a good guy, so we're just going to, like, give you all the stuff, and you can live in a castle, and this guy who's twice your age or more lives in the street? I thought, no, it's not because I'm any better. What's the real difference? And I began to realize that's it, that when I spontaneously responded to him with that little response, that was the difference. I really believe that life would pay whatever price I asked of it. That and 5 other things. I had handled my emotions in a different way because I lived in the street too. I had slept in my car at least. I had no place to go. I had some of the same hardships. And I spent about the next 3 or 4 months studying street people. And I do programs still in the South Bronx and at the Salvation Army there. And we have a program that goes weekly there. I did a fire walk there one time in the South Bronx because I wanted to change people's beliefs in one night about what they were capable of. It's quite amazing. We had several firemen who quit the week before because they almost burned to death. They were, like, freaked out. They didn't die, but they had gone in the fire, and there was a good chance they would have died, so they quit. They want to see these crazy people walking on fire, and they ended up walking and tearing up their resignations and going back to work. We had children, you know, who'd quit school and went back to school. Kids had been D and F students who became C, B, and A students because they thought, God, if I can do this, what else can I do? But I studied street people in more detail, and I found out that we're basically the same as people. We all have our tragedies, some worse than others, but it's how we deal with them and how we deal with these five emotions that makes the difference. So let me give you these five emotions, and let me also warn you, they're not exciting. You know, a lot of people teach, get excited and everything in your life will change. I think excitement is great, but it is not enough. And I could pump you up all day, but these are the five things that keep most people from making their dreams and goals a reality. So let's go through the reality and let's have some fun doing it. Here's the first key to wealth and happiness, and that is you must learn how to manage frustration. You must learn how to manage frustration. You got to learn how to handle frustration, not experience it, but handle it, how to use it, how to break through it. Now, when I share this with most people, they go, oh, that's so simple. Frustration, big deal. Who cares about frustration? You should care. Frustration is one of the greatest silent killers of dreams on the planet. It's like I talked to one of you here, and the person knows who it was, just a little bit ago when we took this break, and the person came up and said, yeah, but what if you've been through it all, and you've tried, and it doesn't work, and it still doesn't work, and you know your limitations? What I hear in that person's voice is a very powerful man who is saying to himself, I'm just too frustrated to try again. And hopefully that person has decided to go for it anyway. But the point is, frustration is what stops people. Frustration turns a positive attitude into a negative one. Some people say, well, why should you care if you have a negative attitude? Well, that person obviously doesn't. But here's why you should care about whether you have a positive or negative attitude. One of the most important reasons to care is this. Write this down in your notes if you would. A negative attitude wipes out self-discipline. A negative attitude wipes out self-discipline. See, it takes away the desire to even try, to even do what's necessary to make your life work the way you want it. I mean, have you ever had the experience where, you know, you work really hard with a customer, you spend all this time with them, I mean, extra amount of time, you do everything you can to help them, and you do the whole thing, and they even decide to buy the carpet, and you come in to tell the manager or someone else there who's your supervisor, person you deal with, or just, you know, your coworker, and you're all excited about this thing, and you go in to tell them that, and about 10 minutes later you get a phone call, and the person calls back and says, we what? Changed our mind. Now, when that happens, you go, wow, isn't that exciting? I can't wait to sell another carpet and spend lots of time with people. Is that usually what happens? You go to sell somebody a home and they turn around and they change their mind. That happens to that person. The real estate salesperson goes, why even try? I spent 4 hours with these people. I gave them my heart and soul. I was honest. I was truthful. This is the result I get for that? Why even try? And it happens to all of us, doesn't it? See, frustration kills it. But yet the reality is, in order to succeed in life, here's the formula. Here's the key to success in life, to wealth and happiness. The key to success in life is getting massive frustration. In fact, the more frustration you get, the more successful you get to become. How does that sound for an exciting? Aren't you glad you showed up for this positive seminar? Go, boy, Robbins, this is really exciting for me. I get to look forward to more frustration. Some people say when you get more success, you'll have less frustrations. You think that's true? Not even slightly. The more successful you become, the more challenges there are. The difference is your ability to handle them, your ability to manage this thing called frustration so that it can motivate you, and maybe even so you can do a magical thing. And the magical thing that helps you to break through frustration is, one, to realize that buried on the other side of frustration is success. And the truth is, so few people succeed because so few people ever learn how to manage just one emotion. And here's another clue that could really assist. You might want to jot this down in your notes. Learn to turn frustration into fascination. It's not hard to do. You can use the skills that you've learned in this program to be able to do this. You can learn to change your state of mind from frustrated to fascinated. It's not that difficult. You can do it in a moment by changing the way you use your body, by changing the way you communicate to yourself, by changing what you're picturing in your mind. If you were really frustrated about something, could you picture that thing you're frustrated with in your mind and do something with it that would change how you feel? What have you learned today that you could do? That's right. You could take that frustrating thing and make it smaller. What else could you do? Push it behind you. Put the problem behind you, especially if there's nothing you can do about it and it's over. What else could you do? Change its color. Change its movement. Change the sound you're hearing. Change the volume. All of those things can be done. You can change from frustration, and you can create a feeling of fascination. right now, as you're listening to my voice, change your body to the kind of state you'd be in if you were really fascinated. Sit the way you'd be sitting if you were fascinated. And put the look on your face like you'd have if you were fascinated. And right now, say something aloud in the tone of voice you'd have if you were fascinated by something. Good. So you now have a physiology reference point that you can go back to. Now you go, well, when would this be useful? Well, wouldn't it be useful the next time somebody does something that normally frustrates you if you suddenly decided, wow, isn't that fascinating? Like, how many of you have ever had somebody, like, cut you off on the road and almost kill you? Anybody had that experience? No, never, right? Now, let me give you a little clue. When that happens, what usually occurs? Do you go, wow, isn't that fascinating how they almost killed me and didn't even notice? What do you tend to do? Yeah, read between the lines, right? You get real upset, you're going to let them know. But see, the problem is they're already gone, aren't they? Does it wreck their day? Whose day gets wrecked when you get frustrated? Yours. And then you walk in the office and somebody goes, how's it going? You go, fine. And now you're treating them rudely. Now they get upset and they treat somebody else rudely. And it's a chain reaction. See, you need to manage frustration into fascination. So the next time somebody cuts you off, you go, isn't it fascinating? I wonder how they went into such a deep trance that they didn't even notice I had a car here. You know, I wonder where they're going that they're like in that much of a hurry. I'm really curious how long they'll live at this pace. Okay? And if you can really do that and play with your emotion in that way, it allows you now in a fascinated state to take action. If you're fascinated, you're going to learn something and you're going to move forward. So that's number one. You've got to learn how to handle frustration, how to manage frustration to succeed, to discover and create wealth and happiness. And there are lots of ways you've learned in this program to do that. Here's the second emotion that must be handled. Second key to wealth and happiness is you must learn how to manage rejection. Those are the moans already. You must learn how to handle rejection. Now, for most people, this is the second biggest killer of dreams. What happens is, if there's anything in this world that you really want that's important to you and that's somewhat unique, then I guarantee in your pursuit of it, there are going to be people who reject you. That's called life. We all know that. But even though we intellectually know that, we tend to do almost anything to avoid personal emotional rejection. And yet the most successful people on the planet, people who have succeeded on the most large scale, are those who both handle frustration and handle rejection on a major scale. Ever heard of the company called Federal Express? Yeah, of course you have. Why? They're the leader in the industry. Why? Because a man named Fred Smith came up with this concept while he was in college. He went to Yale University, top business school, came up with this concept of this company called Federal Express, submitted it as one of his projects, got a C-. Explanation from the professor, it's a stupid idea, it'll never work, because people can use the mail. Why would they pay all this money for overnight service? Yes. Guess what? It wasn't easy either. It didn't just turn overnight. He took all the money he owned at the time. He did have some money. He was doing okay, obviously, to go to Yale University, but he bet everything he had. And no matter how much money you have, when you bet everything you have, it's a lot. And the bottom line is he went out. And the first day Federal Express came into existence, they were supposed to deliver 167 packages. You know how many packages they delivered? Seven. Five of which they sent to themselves. Two packages from the outside world. Can you imagine having jets on a runway and you're delivering two packages? You got a problem. Now, most people at that point would just go, my God, the culture has rejected it. Society says no. Yale University says no. People have personally rejected me, financially rejected me. It's totally frustrating. Forget it. But Fred Smith knew how to handle both frustration and rejection, and he said, we're just going to go. We just need to adjust our strategy. He had passion, right? He believed, and he altered his strategy. He had enough rapport with his clients and also enough rapport with his employees to get him to keep going for it. He had so much rapport that if you worked for Federal Express for the first 2 years, you would not go to a bank to cash your check. You always took your payroll check to a liquor store because it took longer to get back to the bank, gave him more time to try and cover your payroll check. I mean, that's called massive rapport. Federal Express got their airplanes repossessed on a regular basis, where they would have a meeting in the morning with all the guys, and Fred Smith would say, look, guys, we got to sell this many packages today because they repossessed our plane last night, two of our planes, and the only way we're going to get it back is if we make this much of a payment, which means we've got to sell this many packages today. So go sell the packages, bring the money, and we'll buy the planes back and deliver the packages. They literally did that on two different occasions. Well, they went out, and if they wouldn't have sold enough, they were out of business. They sold enough, took the money, went and paid the payment, got the plane back, and delivered your package the next day. I mean, how many people would be willing to handle that kind of frustration and rejection? Very few. See, but now Federal Express is a billion-dollar-a-year enterprise that really created the industry called overnight packages. And Fred Smith, by the way, I want you to know that people who learn to handle frustration and rejection are in the minority in this culture. Very few have learned to really handle it straight on, where they thrive on it, where it makes them grow, where it pushes them, where they feel stronger, where they're inspired by it. Fred Smith is one of those people. And the people who can handle frustration and rejection are the people who get paid very well in the society. Fred Smith last year made over $25 million in personal income. Now, you can't live on that, but it is a good start. Not that, yeah, think of the taxes, he says. The reality is, if you can handle frustration and rejection, there's very little that can stop you in this world. Ever heard of a guy named Rambo? There's a guy who learned how to handle rejection. I don't mean the movie guy, I mean Sylvester Stallone. Sylvester Stallone was turned down by over 1,000 agents, some of them the same agent many times. 1,000 times, over 1,000 times, he'd go to people and be rejected over and over and over again. You know, some people look at him and go, wow, Sylvester Stallone, superstar, look at his life. You know, he's not quite as popular right now as a year ago, but I mean, look at the guy. I mean, you know, he's the best paid actor. He gets what now, 12 or 15 million, 12 million a movie. He's doing what he loves to do. He gets to build his body up while he does what he loves. He takes care of his health. Well, the guy is really lucky. He gets to do this, gets to do that, all those things. He was just born under a lucky star. He probably walked into a casting agent and they just went, whoa, this guy's with a talk like this, hey, Adrian, boy, he's going to be a star. With that stupid look, boy, he's just going to make it. Guess what? They all said, you look stupid. You sound stupid. We don't want any stupid people. Get out of here. I mean, those are the kinds of things people said to him. But he just kept going back for more and more and more because he understood the key to success in life, which you should jot down. The key to success in life, the key to wealth and happiness, is called achieving massive amounts of rejection. Because, see, the more rejection you get, the more what you'll get? Acceptance, success. It's just called a numbers game. You and I both know it. The more people you talk to, the more success you get. Yes, the more rejection you get, but that's part of the numbers. And some of the things you've learned in this program, like how to develop rapport, can help limit the number of rejections, increase the number of acceptances and successes, but it's still part of the ball game. And until you can learn to thrive on it and know that rejection means you're closer to success, then you'll never experience the level of success that you could. Now, a lot of us know all kinds of games we can play in our head. One of the simplest ones is understanding the law of averages. The law of averages in life says that no matter what you're doing in life, that no matter what it is that you're going to go about doing, if you do it enough, you're going to develop an average rate of success. Whatever it is, hitting a baseball or making sales calls. So in other words, the old value of looking at how many no's does it take to get a yes? What if you have to talk to 100 people? You know, with real estate people, it's real easy. I talk to real estate people and I say, how many people you have to talk to get a listing? They say, well, I don't know. You know, some of them say 100, some say 1,000. So most of them say somewhere between 100 and 300. So I say, let's say it took you 200 people to talk to get a listing. How much do you make when a listing sells? They say, well, no less than $2,000. I say, then how much is every no worth? 200 no's made you $2,000. How much is it worth? $10 a no. So I said, what if you associated that? They said, but it's not always that true. I said, well, sometimes it's less and sometimes it's longer, right? But is that an average? They say, yeah. I said, great, then go knock on the door and the person says no. The person says no, say great. And just imagine you put $10 in your pocket. Would that be different than when they say no and slam the door? I mean, how does the average salesperson take this? They knock on the door and they're in real estate sales. They knock on the door, right? Knock, knock, knock. They go, hi, I'm so-and-so with Coldwell Banker Real Estate. And the person goes, you're a real estate agent? And they go, yeah. And they go, bam, and they slam the door in their face. Now, you think that affects their physiology when they go to knock on the next door? You bet it does. The next time, they get about a step back when they ask the question. They say, hi, I'm so-and-so with Coldwell Banker Real Estate. Only now, in their voice, there's a little bit less congruency because they feel a little rejected, don't they? Because they haven't taken that experience and done what with it that you can do? Put it behind them. And so now this person is feeling this emotion, and they go up to do this, and the person goes, you're a real estate agent? And they go, yeah, kind of back up. They go, how do you feed your kids in this market? The person says, but, and they close the door. Now, after about, say, 50 or 100 no's, the average salesperson, like their body, they go knock on the door, and their face and voice says, you wouldn't want to list with me, would you? right? And that happens in your business too, whatever your business is, in any area of your life. But you take that same salesperson and they knock on the door and they go, you're a salesperson, bam, slam the door, and they go, ah, $10, I'm on my way. They knock on the next door and they go, you're a salesperson, real estate sales? They go, yeah, how do you field your kids? He goes, well, just tell me no, and then I made $10. Person goes, wait a second, don't you guys work on commission? He goes, yeah, but I understand how real estate works, and if you say no, I get $10. So just tell me no, but be strong about it, or tell me yes, but be strong about one or the other, because I need to go make some more money. What's going to happen? That person gets a little, they say, you're kind of funny. Come in here. I'd like to talk to you. All of a sudden, there's a whole different emotion, isn't there? The key is to realize that rejection's part of it. Ever heard of a lady named Tina Turner? How many of you like her? Great. Tina Turner. She's a super success because she has the greatest voice of any woman vocalist on the planet. Is that right? No. Why is she a success? Does she have passion? Let me ask you this. Does she have passion? Does she believe in herself? Does she have a strategy of like how to move her body? Does she have the ability to bond with a large audience? Is she clear on her values? Does it come across when people interview her? You bet they does. Does she have energy? Yeah. Is she pretty clear in how to master her communication to herself and other people? She's mastered auditory communication in the external world, hasn't she? Not only that, but guess what? This woman handled massive frustration and massive rejection that very few people could ever stand. Because she was very famous many years ago, wasn't she? Ike and Tina Turner, remember? What happened? Yeah, he beat her up, he abused her, he was on drugs, according to the stories. One day they went to go do a particular place in Germany, a concert. Big concert place, supposed to have, you know, 10,000 people. And like 150 people were there. He said, I'm not going on. He was all drugged out. She said, the show must go on, and she went out and did it. Afterwards, she left. She left with nothing but a Shell credit card and I think like 37 cents. Or somewhere, maybe it was a couple dollars, I forgot the exact amount, but it wasn't more than $10. She left, and everyone pursued her and sued her for going off the concert tour. She just said, he can have everything. I don't want any part of this thing. She then spent the next 8 years of her life in the purgatory known as little halls and known as little bars where nobody listens to you. They just get drunk, and you happen to be singing nearby. I mean, that's bad enough for anyone. I feel for anybody who's in that position because it's massive rejection. You got to really work on your head, can you imagine? But for somebody who's been a superstar to do that, but she went at it for 8 years and didn't give up on her dream. Kept going, going, going. Kept calling people. Nobody in Hollywood would return her phone calls even. Finally, one man believed in her and corralled a few other people and got them to write some songs for her. And they created this thing called the Private Dancer LP. And she came back and sold 8 million albums and got a Grammy. Not bad. Now, I'm sure she would have rather had 1 million albums a year for 8 years. But that's not how life is. She was willing to go for 8 years. She was willing to go until. She was willing to handle massive amounts of frustration, massive amounts of rejection, and that's why she's a superstar. And that's why so few people ever make it in that business, because so few people manage that emotion. You be one of those people that manages frustration and rejection, and you will be a superstar in anything that you do. Here's number three. You must learn how to handle financial pressure. Some of you are smiling, meaning you're working on this one right now. You must learn how to handle financial pressure. Now, money certainly isn't everything in life, but it plays a major role in a Western culture because what money does in a Western culture is it amplifies. Money can buy you a certain amount of time if it's used properly. In other words, things that you normally have to spend energy to do, you can hire someone else to do. It can give you a certain level of freedom to travel, etc. A lack of money also seems to have an impact in this culture on the emotional state of large numbers of people. Not everyone, but most people. How many of you have ever had so much financial pressure that you started treating people around you in a very rude or obnoxious way, and it wasn't about them, it was just about the financial pressure you had? How many have had that experience? Yeah, almost all of us.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over at this point to play side two.
The reality then is, some people say, well, that's great, I'll just make more money and I'll have less financial pressure. Is that true? No way in a million years. The more money you make, the more you tend to what? The more you tend to spend. So what happens is you're in this loop. I mean, if you look at a guy like Ted Turner, do you think he has some financial pressure? But see, the difference is Ted Turner has more money because he learned how to manage the small amounts, so he got to manage larger amounts. And the bottom line is most people never learn how to handle the small amounts. They never learn how to handle the pressure. And what happens is, as a result, that pressure squeezes them and makes them never even want to have the financial freedom they could have. So what's the key to this? Well, it's not just to make more money, but obviously learn to manage the money that you have, so that now money becomes a tool for you instead of you being a tool of money. You know, it talks in the Bible about money is the root of all evil. It doesn't actually say that. It says the love of money is the root of all evil, which means when you let money become your master, instead of you mastering it as just one more tool of living, of daily living that can support you. And I've seen more people devastated emotionally because of financial pressure and what it represented to them than just about any other problem. I've seen marriage problems. I've seen problems with children. I've seen people do the weirdest things just out of financial pressure. So as I grew up around it constantly. And one of the things I wanted to make sure was I didn't have that in my life. So I made a lot of money. And guess what? All of a sudden, I found that people around me rejected me. People I'd grown up with, they felt uncomfortable. They felt like, well, they weren't making as much money as me, so they started making these weird comments and started feeling bad. I didn't care if they made as much money as I made. It didn't make any difference to me at all. All I wanted was financial freedom. But what I rigged up in my mind was if you make a lot of money, people start to judge you. I rigged up in my mind that people don't love you as much. And so I got rid of all the money, not consciously, but unconsciously. And I went for a very, very long time where I didn't make any money, and I had a tremendous amount of financial pressure constantly, and where I felt really lousy about myself. And finally, fortunately in my business, like yours, the more people I serve and the more people I help, the more money I make. So I stopped focusing on money, and I just focused on giving incredible service and helping as many people as I could and putting my all into everything I did, and my money challenges turned around. I went from $125,000 in debt, where I had, you know, never made that much money in my life, to $1 million net worth in 12 months. And the way that I did that was two ways. The first way is I had to change my thinking processes, because it's not working harder that makes the difference. It has to do with what's going on in your head. And I had to change my own beliefs about what I was worth. And the way I did that is by focusing not on what I could get, but on what I could give. You know, there's a great book you should go get and read if you haven't already read it. And if you've read it before, read it again. It's called The Richest Man in Babylon. The Richest Man in Babylon. It's by a man named George Clason. It's a very simple book. You can read it in an hour, hour and a half, very thin. It's kind of metaphorical. And it'll tell you about the foundational keys of wealth building and basically how to eliminate financial pressures so in your lifetime, money doesn't run you, you run money. And it's just a tool for you. And I'll give you three of the things that it had in there that I applied that turned me around. Three of the simplest things that we can do in the couple of minutes we're here together with. Number one, it said take 10% of your money and immediately give it away. Now, since I was totally broke, this philosophy did not appeal to me very much. I said, well, when I make some money, I'll give it away. And in the book it said, no, no, no. You must give it when you don't have it. That's when you've got to plant it. When all you have left is seed corn and you're a farmer, you don't eat your seed corn. You invest it into the soil. And what he said basically is that there are two reasons why you want to give 10%. One reason to do this is as soon as you give, what it does to your brain is it says there is more than enough. See, if you're willing, in the face of all the things around you not working, to take 10% of what you got and give it away, it's saying to your brain there's more than enough. And when your brain gets that message, it starts manifesting that as a reality. Maybe this sounds esoteric to you, but it's called how the brain functions. It's how it works. In addition, you should want to do it because it gives you so much joy to give, because that's what we're really here on the planet to do anyway. We feel best when we're contributing, not just when we're getting. And I remember the day that turned it around for me. I was living in Marina Del Rey, California, and I was totally broke. I wasn't sure where my next money was going to come from. I had a little bit more than $20 in my pocket. I don't remember the exact amount, maybe $21, $22. And I was figuring out how I was going to survive this next week. So I decided what I was going to do is I was going to go eat at this place where there's this big salad bar, you know, smorgasbord things. I figured I'd tank up for a few days worth of stuff all at one time for the most least amount of money I could spend. So I go down there and I'm eating and I'm stuffing my face. And as I'm sitting there, this little kid, I don't know how old, maybe 5, 6, 7 years old, in this little suit, and this really beautiful woman who's obviously his mother, come into the restaurant and sit down. And what's really neat is this little boy goes over and he pulls a chair out for his mom and he, you know, sets her down. He sits down a little dignified. And it really affected me emotionally to see this. It was really touching. So I watched them while I was eating, and I just saw the rapport they had and what I consider to be the respect and just joy for each other, and I just thought it was so delightful, and I got inspired. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to do something. So I got up after I was done eating, and I walked over, and I introduced myself to this little boy. I just walked up to him, and I said, hi, my name is Tony. And he went, oh, hi, my name is Johnny. I said, hi, Johnny. I said, I couldn't help but notice you from across the room here and see how incredible you are in taking care of your lady here, taking her to lunch. And he said, well, she's not my lady. She's my mom. I said, oh, all the more impressive. And I said, it's really neat that you're willing to take her to lunch like this. He goes, well, I didn't actually take her because I can't drive for many years. And he said, and I'm not paying because I don't have a job yet, but I will someday. And I said, yeah, you are paying for her lunch. He said, no, I can't. I said, yes, you can. And I took all the money I had left, which was maybe $14 or $15, and I put it on the table in front of him. And he looked at me kind of starry-eyed, and he said, oh, I can't take this. I can't do this. And I said, yes, you can. He said, why? I said, because I'm bigger than you are. And he just grinned, and I grinned back at him. And I didn't look at his mom or anything like that. I wasn't doing it for that reason. That would just destroy why I was doing it. I just turned, and I walked out of the building. I shouldn't say walk. I think I flew, because I felt so incredible inside. I felt so light. Now, some of you may say, well, that's pretty crazy. You don't have any money now. What are you going to do? What are you going to eat? Well, I thought about that later, too. But in the moment, I felt so incredible about myself and my life that I was that kind of person, as simple as that little gesture was, that all of a sudden, I just felt like I knew something was going to happen. I knew things were going to be taken care of. And the next day, with no money, the mail came, and I got a check for $1,100 from a guy I'd loaned money to about 3 years earlier, who I never thought I'd see the money from again and had not called. Now, you might say, well, that's coincidence, and you may be right. But all I know is that day, emotionally for me, was a day where I went, there's more than enough, and I made this change in my head to how am I going to survive to I know what's going to happen, and I'm just going to keep giving until it does. And it began an incredible shift for me. And I started focusing on what I could give instead of what I could take, and all of a sudden I started getting a lot more than I was giving in my mind. You know, I consciously do this on a regular basis. You know, I mentioned earlier when I was growing up on Thanksgiving, one time there was no money and there was no food. And somebody came and knocked on our door one day. And I opened the door, and here's this man standing with this huge box of food and a giant turkey and even some pans to cook it in. And like, I couldn't even believe it. My mom came out, my dad came out, and we said, you know, who are you? Where are you from? He said, I'm just here because a friend of yours knows you're in need and knows you wouldn't accept direct help. So I'm here, and this is for you. Have a great Thanksgiving. We said, no, we can't accept. He said, you don't have a choice. And he closed the door, and he left. And obviously, that model impacted my life. And I promised myself that someday I would do well enough financially to do that for other people. So by the time I was 18, every Thanksgiving, I made it a little ritual that I would go out, and I like to do things spontaneously. And I go out shopping and buy enough food for one or two families, and I go drive to the poorest area and just knock on a door and dress down like I'm just the delivery boy, and I do that. And I put a little note in there that says, when I was a kid, this is what happened to me. And the bottom line is, if you'll just take good care enough of yourself that someday you can do it for someone else, that's all that I ask, if you have the chance to do that. And it's been, I've gotten more out of that ceremony that I do every year than any amount of money that I've ever earned. And about 2 years ago, I was actually over in New York City, and I was doing a seminar there, and I was here on Thanksgiving with my new wife. And my wife and I were together, and it's like, you know, she's like real teary-eyed and crying and weepy and stuff, because here we are at Thanksgiving, and we're in this little hotel room, and we're not with our family. And she's like really upset, saying, normally, you know, I'd be decorating the tree and all these things. And she says, you know, and here we are stuck in this hotel room. And I said, honey, I said, look, why don't we decorate some lives today instead of decorating some trees? And I told her about what I always did on Thanksgiving. And she got all excited about it. And I said, let's go someplace where we can really appreciate who we are and what we're capable of and where we can really give. I said, let's go to Harlem. She wasn't like real enthusiastic about that. And I have several partners, and they were here too. And I said, let's all go to Harlem and feed people in Harlem. And we won't be the persons giving it, because that would be insulting. We'll just be the delivery people. We'll go buy enough food for like 5, 6, 7 families for 30 days. We got enough money. Let's just go do it. Let's, you know, that's what Thanksgiving is, giving thanks, not eating dead turkey. You know, let's go do it. So I had to go do a radio interview, and I said, go get a van. And I came back, and they said, well, you just can't do it. There are no vans in all of New York. The rent-a-car places are out of vans. People have gone out of town. They're just not available. And I said, look, the bottom line is, if we want something, we can make it happen. All we have to do is take action. There are plenty of vans here in New York City. We just don't have one. Let's go get one. They said, but we've called everywhere. I said, look down at the street. We looked down. I said, you see that? They said, yeah, what are you saying? See all those vans? And I said, yeah. I said, well, let's go get one. So we went down, and I understood the law of averages, and I understood we'd have to manage frustration and rejection, and we went down, and we just started knocking on people's windows at the light. First, they didn't do that. First, I'd walk in front of vans as they're driving, and I just, like, try and stop them, and I learned something about New York drivers. They speed up. They don't stop. So then we waited by the light. And we go over and knock on the window, and the guy rolled down the window, kind of leery looking at us, and I'd say, hi, you know, today's Thanksgiving, we find ourselves in a good place, and we'd like to know if you'd be willing to drive us to Harlem so we could feed some people. Window rolls up, boom, they drive up without saying anything. So then we got better at asking. And we'd knock on the window, and they'd roll the window down, and I'd say, today's Thanksgiving, we'd like to help some underprivileged people, and we're curious if you'd be willing to drive us to an underprivileged area that we have in mind here in New York City, without saying what the area was, and they were a little closer. Then we started offering people $100 to drive us to a place. That got even closer, but when we told them where it was, they said no. Finally, we talked to like about a dozen people, and they'd all said no. My partners were going, give up on this. I said, it's the law of averages. We ask enough people, somebody's going to say yes. So sure enough, this perfect van comes up, extra big, because there were four partners with me. Extra big van. We go up, we knock on this guy's window. We tell him, hey, could you take us there and so forth? We'll pay you $100. And the guy turns back to us and he says, you don't have to pay me. I'd be happy to take you. In fact, I'll take you to some of the most difficult spots in the whole city. And then he reaches over and he grabs his hat and he puts his hat on. And on the hat it says, Salvation Army. There was nothing on the van that said that. And his name was Captain John Rondon. He's the head of the Salvation Army now in the Bronx. He was in the South Bronx at the time. And at the time, I mean, we got in the car, and we were like in ecstasy. And he said, I'll take you places you've never thought of going. Why do you want to do this? And I told him the story about my life. And I said, I wanted to appreciate what I had. I wanted to give something back. So he took us into the South Bronx. I don't know if you've ever been there or not. But it's an interesting place. There are a lot. I mean, I think it makes Harlem look like, you know, Beverly Hills in comparison. I mean, Harlem is not quite that extreme, but it's pretty intense. Buildings that are blown completely out. And we went around and we fed people. We went in this shop and we bought all this food. The shop maker loved us. And we pulled in, we have all these baskets and we're buying all this food for seven families for 30 days. And we go out to start feeding people. And we go into these buildings where there are like a half dozen people living with no, you know, squatters, living with no electricity, no heat in the dead of winter, in a little room filled with rats, cockroaches, smells like urine. It was amazing. And the interesting thing that really educated me most there, besides the emotion, was that Captain John showed me this one building, and he said, how old do you think this building is? And I said, I don't know, it looks like it's about 7,500 years old. He said, no, it's 3 years old. I said, 3 years old? I mean, the building was totally destroyed. And he said, wait, before you ask anything, wait, just be silent for a second. And he drove us four blocks further down the street. And he said, how old do you think this building is? And I said, I don't know, it looks like it's 2 or 3 years old. He said, yeah, it's about 3 years old. I said, what's the difference? They're four blocks away, and they're built about the same time. They're totally different. He said, well, in the first building, we built it, and we just put people in it. In the second building, he said, before we let people move in, we educated them for 6 weeks on how to live in a building. Things like how not to urinate in the elevators. I said, come on, people know you don't urinate in the elevators. He said, no, they didn't. It wasn't they're trying to be bad. They didn't know. He said, so we educated them, and that's why the building is here. And what grabbed me in that whole experience was people do the best they can with the resources they have, and some people don't have a model that they can succeed. Some people don't have a belief that it's possible. And you can generate for yourself such an incredible feelings of emotion that are so valuable to your whole lifelong success if you can give something. I've gotten more out of those processes than anything else. So my challenge to you is to give 10%, and I know it may be difficult now, but if you're telling yourself, well, when I make more money, then I'll give 10%, check it again. What do you think is easier, to give a dime out of a dollar or 100,000 out of a million? Trust me. The bigger the amounts, the more difficult it is unless you establish the pattern now. And if you establish the pattern now, it's so easy. Here's what you do with the other 10%, and I'll give you these last two. Take 10% and use it to reduce your debts. Pay off MasterCharge, Visa, Arnold's Linoleum, whoever you owe money to, and take 10% and use it to either invest, or if it's too small right now, save it to invest. We live in a capitalistic society that we have people who founded this country so we would have those choices, and very few of us are capitalists. That's why so many people are unhappy. I spent 3.5 weeks in Russia, traveling all over Russia. I got to tell you, there, if you try and buy something and sell it for a profit, it's called 5 years in prison. I mean, they don't have the choices you have. We all have the opportunity to be capitalists. You want to study how to invest so that your financial pressure can be eased in the long term. Then it says take 70% and use that basically to live on. And the problem is people say, but I don't have enough money to do all this. You don't have enough money not to. That's the reality. Handle financial pressure and things will change. And again, I'm not saying money will solve all your problems. It will not. But money will allow you to arrive at your problems in style, where you can handle things from a whole different place. Here's number 4 of the 5. When you handle frustration, and you handle rejection, and you handle financial pressure, then you'll start really succeeding. Then number 4 kicks in and wipes out all the good you've begun to do. And number 4 is you must learn how to handle or manage complacency. Complacency is a real killer because it's that little thing called comfort zones that gets involved. Complacency is when you go, well, God, I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing all right. And we all have that little place called a comfort zone, a place where we feel like we're doing pretty well. And there's nothing wrong with having a comfort zone except this. It doesn't make you happy to live in your comfort zone. What it does is it makes you feel satisfied only for so long, and then you start looking for distractions. You start looking to drink or eat or do something else, because the only way you're going to be happy in life is not by what you get, but by what you become. Who you become as a person is what will eventually make you happy now and in the future. What you get won't make you happy. So the reality is if you're not growing, we all know you're beginning to die. There's no, you know, plateau. We're either moving up or we're moving down. And the reality for most people is we tend in life to get comfortable because we tend to judge ourselves by our peers. And here's how you break out of complacency. Here's the solution. There are twofold solutions. One, learn to judge yourself by your goals and not by your peers. Learn to judge yourself by your goals, by your potential, rather than by your peers. See, I used to feel really good about myself in terms of like my level of success. Like I didn't have to do anything more in my life because I compared myself to my friends. I said, I'm doing much better than my friends. Of course, my friends weren't doing very well, but that's who I was comparing myself with. So you really want to make sure it's based on your values, not just the people around you. Otherwise, you get caught in a trap. The other thing is write down to please pay careful attention to who you associate to and with. Because who you associate with plays a major role in what you're willing to accept of yourself, your ability, and your skill. The people around you impact your values. And sometimes people you really care about, without meaning to, have a very negative effect. It's like one time, I remember this one guy gave a great example. He said, he was talking to some children. He said, kids, I got a question for you. What if I have this cup of coffee and my worst enemy comes along and he drops 2 lumps of sugar in my coffee? What will happen? And all the kids chanted back, nothing, you'll be fine. He said, what if my best friend, even by accident, drops 1 drop of strychnine in my coffee? Even by accident, what happens? And they all went, you're dead. He said, that's right. He said, in life, your mind is like your coffee. You need to be very, very careful about who dumps what inside of it. So lesson one is watch your coffee. Make sure every single day you pay attention to what's going inside and who you're associating with. An example for myself, my goal was that when I was 19 years old, my number one goal was to retire, to make enough money to retire. My idea of success was make a ton of money because I grew up poor. So I thought money was the big solution. And my idea of success was you retire, and I lived in California, so you retire at 19, and you have an office on Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills, and you just show up on a regular basis to look good. I remember the day when I got the office. It was right after my 19th birthday. I was in ecstasy. I pulled up in my car, and a valet comes out to take your car in front of the office, and I thought, this is my office building, and in my office, we have a valet. Just as I'm about to walk into the office, this limousine pulls up. And I think to myself, these are the kind of people that work in my office building. So I'm waiting to see who it is. Maybe it's somebody famous or something, right? So sure enough, the chauffeur gets out, walks around, opens the door, and this little kid, couldn't be more than 7 or 8 years old, maybe 9 max, gets out in a three-piece suit, you know, pocket square, the whole nine yards, looks really cute, I think that's really nice, I'm waiting to see his father. Nobody else gets out. They slam the door. As they slam the door, there's an office on the main level called Pruitt Enterprises. And this man comes running out of the office and says, Mr. Pruitt, Mr. Pruitt. He says, please hurry. New York is on the line, and everybody's waiting for you to run the meeting. Now I look around thinking, is this like Canon camera or something? You know, what is going on here, right? So I look around. I thought maybe it's a practical joke or something. Nothing I can see. So I go up to the chauffeur, and I go, whose kid is that? He said, it's not whose kid it is. He said, that's Mr. Pruitt. I said, what is he, a dwarf? He said, no, no. He's an 11-year-old self-made millionaire. I said, come on. I said, his dad set him up, right? He said, no, he didn't. I said, how does an 11-year-old become a self-made millionaire? He said, he started when he was 7 mowing lawns. I said, he mowed to a million? He said, no, no, but he mowed lawns, and he did it on a regular basis, and he took all of his money, and he bought hamsters. And I said, so what does that got to do with anything? He said, do you know how rapidly hamsters multiply? I said, no. He said, they really go fast. And I said, so what? He said, we got all his friends who, like, have all these hamster cages, and he expanded and expanded and expanded, and he reinvested everything. He didn't spend any of it. Then at one point, he sold all of his hamsters and his whole business at a huge profit, and he took money, and he bought silver right around the time that, I guess, the hunch did. He sold before they sold. He took his profits and leveraged it and bought a bunch of real estate. He now has two companies, the guy says. He's a millionaire, and this is where his base of operation is. This kid, I was feeling really good about myself. 19, retiring, right? This kid wrecked my whole day, right? I look at this kid, he can't drive for 5 more years. And all of a sudden, I started thinking, well, gosh, no matter how well you think you're doing, there's always somebody who's doing better. And that's worthy of our remembering. Because if there's someone doing better, then that means you could be doing better as well. And that's what the passion of life is. It's called growth. So watch who you associate to, and make sure you put yourself in a position where you cause yourself to grow and you don't get too satisfied. Here's the last one, number 5. When you handle frustration, you handle rejection, you handle financial pressure, you handle complacency, now you're well on your way, you're going to succeed. Number 5 is one I've already talked about basically, but it's a way of guaranteeing long-term success. And it appears your company is focused on this as well. And that is called always give much more than you expect to receive. Always give much more than you expect to receive. That's called formula for wealth and happiness. If you can focus on what can I give, you'll never have to worry about what you can receive because you'll always get much more back. And the best way to get yourself in this place is, remember, the secret to living is giving. And to put yourself in a place where you can find some kind of situation in your life where you love giving so much that it's not a task, where you love what you do so much that you feel privileged to be involved in the organization and the business that you're in. And I hope for you that you have found that with this company. I know many of you have from the way you've communicated, and I found that for myself. So my invitation to you is to live it even more than you have in the past and to have even greater and deeper appreciation for the joy that you have in life and what you can give to people. Because I want to say something to you, and that is that if you focus on selling, you'll do okay. And if you focus on how to change lives and give people the emotions that they want through your product and service and through your input in that day, then you get to become wealthy. And it's easier to become wealthy than it is to do well. And I challenge you and I invite you to become as wealthy as you possibly can be. Good night and God bless.